Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from the Museum of Modern Art in San Francisco. I am Stephanie Salter, San Francisco Examiner columnist and quarterly chair of the Commonwealth Club. We also welcome the listeners of WMEM 106.1 FM in Presque Isle, Maine, one of more than 225 radio stations around the nation carrying America's longest-running radio program. At this time, it is my pleasure to introduce today's speaker. In March 1998, when David Ross was appointed director of the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, the Chronicle's art critic, Kenneth Baker, wrote a lengthy analysis of the news, discussing Ross's tenure at the Whitney Museum in New York, and specifically his supervision of the most controversial biennial retrospective in that museum's history. Baker wrote, "That stigma, it is not too strong a word, may stain Ross's collection-building efforts at SF MoMA." 3 months later, Ross's very first week on the job as director of SF MoMA, the museum announced that it had just acquired $40 million worth of modern and contemporary works to its collection. The bulk came through the generosity of the woman for whom this theater is named, Phyllis Wattis. The artist, Robert Rauschenberg, contributed an impressive chunk by selling SF MoMA about a dozen of his own paintings from his personal collection. So much for stigmas and stains. A native New Yorker, but ferocious champion of California artists, David Ross directed the Whitney from 1991 until his appointment to SF MoMA. Before the Whitney, he served for 9 years as director of the Institute of Contemporary Art in Boston. During the late 1970s, Ross was the assistant director for collections and programs and chief curator of the University Art Museum in Berkeley, and was deputy director for programs at the Long Beach Museum of Art. Under his leadership at the Whitney, the museum added 30% more exhibition space and raised $45 million to finance that expansion and to fund a complete renovation of the Whitney's Marcel Brewer building. Ross also established a 7-year collaborative arrangement with the San Jose Museum of Art to share masterpieces from the Whitney's permanent collection for long-term exhibition in San Jose. When he was appointed director of San Francisco MoMA, Ross said he was sad to leave the Whitney, but, he said, "I finally learned how to run an art museum. And when I asked myself what part of the world would be receptive to my vision, the best answer was here, San Francisco. Among the many attractive elements of SF MoMA," he said, "I can't think of another place where the museum, the modern museum, has become the city museum. Since he took over at SF MoMA, the museum has played host to 2 exhibitions he organized or co-organized at the Whitney, Keith Haring and Richard Diebenkorn. To say these 2 shows were wildly successful here is like saying Picasso had a way with a brush." Another Ross Whitney show, a 25-year survey of video artist Bill Viola's work, currently is packing them in here at SF MoMA. Ladies and gentlemen, Commonwealth Club members, it's my pleasure to present David Ross.
Thank you very much, Stephanie. Quite a nice introduction, and I'm not going to play with the hammer here, although it's tempting. It's a great honor to speak to the Commonwealth Club. I'm glad I didn't look at the list of distinguished speakers who have come before me speaking to this club, because it would have absolutely paralyzed me had I looked and seen the company that I'm honored to be part of. And it's a pleasure to also have you here at the Museum of Modern Art. We see this museum as a very hospitable place for the kinds of discussions that Commonwealth Club has long championed, and hope that you'll come here again and again, even if you don't invite me to do the lecture. The title of my talk this afternoon is "A Modern Museum for the 21st Century." And you might imagine that I'm talking about this museum, since it is a modern museum, and we are about to enter the 21st century. And in a way, I am, but I'm also speaking more generically about modern museums and about museums on a broader level. This is a very important moment for us all to think about the institutions that we care about. That's one of the convenient things that ends of centuries allow us to do, even if they are arbitrary and somewhat meaningless. In fact, the reality that follows the kind of concentrated reconsideration of our institutions is good for all of us. So I will take it with a grain of salt that the 21st century will be dramatically different than the last days of the 20th century. On the other hand, the reality is that we know that change is taking place, and we'd best be prepared for it. So again, on behalf of the trustees here, who are quite pleased to hear that you are coming, I welcome you. Sometimes I wonder what a first-time visitor to this museum thinks about their experience of the art museum. A good friend of mine from New York, who was a neighbor in our building on Madison Avenue, who works actually in the news business, brought his family here last year for a holiday, and we had dinner after his visit to the museum, and I was thrilled to hear from him something that I had never considered asking someone who had come to the museum before. He said, "You know, I walked around this museum and everyone had a smile on their face. People were really happy. And I can't say I ever had imagined before in thinking about our visitors whether people were happy." I said, "Well, weren't people happy when you visited the Whitney Museum? Didn't you see people with smiles on their face?" He says, "Oh, no one in New York smiles. It's kind of too dangerous. You might be communicating with someone if you smiled." But here people literally were smiling. People were having a good time in the museum. And I was really pleased by that. And I remain pleased by that, but it also made me think that it's important that we think carefully about how our visitors feel about their experience in the museums. And so we regularly ask our visitors to complete surveys that help us understand how they may feel. But still I wonder whether I can truly understand the level of their surprise and hopefully the level of their delight that a first-time visitor to SF MoMA might experience if today was his or her first visit. Imagine a visitor walking into the McCune Gallery on the top of the steps, entering onto the fourth floor, and walking straight ahead to the image of the fire and water work known as The Crossing by the artist Bill Viola, who was mentioned just recently. His enormously affecting work in which two individuals, one is consumed by fire and one is consumed by water, which serves as the beginning and ending of the retrospective exhibition of his work now on view in the museum. If our imagined visitor was able to slow down and allow the 12 minutes or so to unfold, he or she would see on a 20-foot screen hung in the center of the room a projected image of a man slowly walking towards him from the depths of a darkened space. If our visitor walked around to the other side of the screen, he would see the same man walking towards him at the same slow pace. If our mythical visitor stayed in the gallery and breathed deeply and slowly and let the work unfold, he might see both men stop simultaneously and slowly one become consumed by fire while the other was simultaneously consumed, transformed by water. Metaphorical implications aside for the moment, we place that work in the center of the retrospective of Viola's work because it not only explores this particularly resonant transformation in a manner that is visually and emotionally arresting, but because it itself functions as a transition from the high-velocity life of the world outside the museum and the space that the museum provides. A very particular and special space, museum space, a space whose qualities and characteristics are unique and uniquely important at this moment in time, a space defined by the experience within it, obviously, but more than that, a space defined by the notion that inspired its construction in the first place, and that notion we'll call modernity. So first, maybe we should discuss what we mean by the word modern, modernity, modernism. We keep using this word over and over again. Here we are, a museum of modern art. And I fear that this word is one of those words in our culture that's lost its meaning. We use it so often. So since it's at the crux of our identity as an institution, perhaps we ought to just talk about it for a little bit. Modern is one of those words that's been exhausted as a result of its relentless application during this soon-to-be-over century. Of course, modern means simply of the day or pertaining to the present, but we have elevated this term by using it to describe nothing less than the aspirations to fully engage the world with as much control as we can muster, to be modern, to be in charge, to understand how much of the world around us we can make in our own image. Modern is an active term. To be modern is to make a choice not to be something else. Not what? Not traditional, not pre-modern, not passive, not old-fashioned. Well, the 20th century was a century defined, in fact, by this idea of modernity. And one way or another, we've all had to come to grips with it year in, year out, as the century has progressed. This century, which is defined by this term modernity, is a century also that has at its core a term with its roots in mid-19th century scientific, aesthetic, and philosophic advance. And being modern, as a result of all of that intense focus, developed into a sort of cult. We live in the cult of the modern. The cult of being modern developed its own set of rules. It developed an orthodoxy. It developed its own language. Modern language describes the operation of modernity. Modern poetry describes its soul. Modern music is how we keep time in the modern age. Modern architecture presents the shareable vision of the modern city, the embodiment of modern life. Modernism is expressed in every aspect of the built and designed environment. And of course, modern art constitutes a new universe of pure invention, the source of the cult of the new. To be modern is often to be taken as synonymous with progress, with progressive politics. But modernity can also be an effective cover for the destruction of the human touch, for the elimination of the human being. The machine can be, and often has throughout the century, been promoted beyond its necessity, and many a 20th century nightmare was born from machine dreams gone awry. Knowing modernity as we do, we know it in our hearts, even if we can't describe it, including its dark side. We still have little left to fear of its misuse, yet we should remain aware of that very, very real potential. As surely as we know that all change is not to be feared, we should not mindlessly embrace change for its own sake, even in the name of modernity. All things considered, one might even say that the idea of embracing the modern and being unafraid of the new was the requisite badge of courage that one needed to make it through this century. Yet modernism, the practice of being modern, is defined in opposition to traditional forms of expression and behavior. To embrace the modern meant to turn away from the hegemony of the established order, and it required an embrace of an order derived from the assumption that our life was in some fashion perfectible, that it was man-made, and that the man-made was equal to the divine. That's a very radical idea. It is important to remember that as trite and as almost quaint as the term may sound today, modernism evolved from and was in many ways the engine of revolution and revolutionary change in this century. As the great art historian T.J. Clark certainly implies in his great study of modernism entitled Farewell to an Idea, there was a direct ideological link between what came to be called modern art and all of the art and thought that preceded it. Contiguous with revolutionary movements throughout Europe, the rise of modern thought was both at the intellectual and spiritual root of 20th century social and economic revolution. It also provided it with an appropriate new set of tools with which to explore the changes that this new world would bring about. As we all know, modern art was an integral part of the Russian Communist Revolution. It not only announced its rupture from traditional forms of government, but it announced a brave new world where spirit and human endeavor could possibly be merged. This, in many ways, was the hallmark of modernity, despite the failure of the communist experiment. The movement towards a non-representational art was perhaps the most radical, though parallel movements in music and literature were equally powerful, compelling, and disturbing to the idea of the status quo. The development of the modern, in this sense, was about the construction of new language capable of expressing the revolutionary new ideas in a totally fresh manner, a manner which would be uninflected by, uninfluenced by, beyond the control of established languages, established critical standards, and academic disciplinary structures. If new, then fully new. To be modern meant all of this, and it implied even more. Some art historians, including Doug Nickel, the Art Museum's curator, who organized the current Carlton Watkins exhibition you'll see later, locates the origins of the modern movement in 1839 with the invention of photography. Not a 20th century invention, but early 19th century. And as the German humanist critic Walter Benjamin would tell us in his 1939 essay, The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, photography changed everything. When answering a question as to whether or not photography could be considered art, he reposed the question in a broader question. Has not photography changed everything about the world, including the ways in which we see, including the ways in which we consider what art is? For the first time in human history, seeing and remembering were mechanized, made directly reproducible. Painters were freed to do something else. Artists were free to take on tasks that were curiously consistent with the goals of modernity, especially the relentless questioning of the visual world. Others, other historians, other minds later looking at the birth of modernity, like the biologist and cultural historian Stephen Jay Gould, tie the birth of modernism, the birth of the modern, to an understandable development stemming from one particular publication. And knowing Gould's predilections, you can probably guess that, from his point of view, it was the 1859 publication of Darwin's Origins of the Species that gave root to the growth of modernism. Gould states that the very idea that man's fate was not linked to some notion of divinity, but rather was something directly linked to the human capacity to think, learn, invent, and thus improve the world, or at least make it more in what we might short-sightedly believe to be our direct interest as a species, gave birth to the idea of modernity. This idea places man in a very different role compared to that which more traditional philosophies and theologies might have previously described. The modern, to post-Darwinian thinkers, was a world in which the possibility of a better world lay in human hands, would be a function of our own will to invent the new, to break fully from the past, and to find a new set of ideal human values. Is modernism merely another front for humanism? No. To paraphrase Benjamin, it is a humanistic framework for the reinvention of the world, and nothing short of the way we perceive it. As Clark notes in the introduction to Farewell to an Idea, modernism had two great wishes. It wanted its audience to be led towards a recognition of the social reality of the sign, away from the comforts of narrative and illusion, was the claim. But equally, it dreamed of turning the sign back to a bedrock of world, nature, sensation, subjectivity, which the to and fro of capitalism had all but destroyed by the end of the 19th century. But that said, Clark positions the origins of the modern much earlier, in 1793, with the first public viewing of Jacques-Louis David's The Death of Marat. Viewed one way or another, the idea of the modern, the idea of modernity itself, is still the best term we can come up with to describe the momentous shifts in perception, thinking, in work, art, and social relations that took place as the world pressed into and through the Industrial Revolution. And as we exit the other side of that long moment, into a time defined by new technologies, new technological paradigms, and yet unnamed new responses to these changes, we find that modernity has not yet disappeared, has not yet become useless as a term, and in fact seems, and this may be a grand illusion, stronger than ever. Now let's spend a moment or two on the idea of the art museum, and then we can marry the terms. The art museum, as we know by standard definition, collects, preserves, and educates. That is the standard definition that is held for most of this century. That is not, however, a fixed idea handed down with the tablets to Moses on on the mountain. It is an idea that we have invented. It is not as fixed as an idea as one might imagine. It is not an invention with its roots as deep as the university, for instance, with its origins in the medieval monastery. It is not even a concept with roots as deep as the library, with links to the first attempts to organize and control knowledge as an extension of the power of the church or the court. The art museum stems directly from another courtly invention, the royal Wunderkabinett, and from the need of the court to house items of tribute and the loot which history has always assumed was the property of the victorious. It has always had, broadly speaking, an educational role, but symbolically it has always stood as a site of power. When Napoleon first opened the Louvre, in many ways the first public museum, it was a reflection of his imperial power and a badge of pride for all those who shared in the reflective glory of the empire and all that it contained and controlled. The power and wealth of the empire was physically displayed in a quite convincing and dramatic fashion, making absolutely clear the role that France held as the center of the world and as the proper repository for the finest achievements of the subjects of the empire, which, after all, was everyone. Today, of course, we see the art museum in a very different light. Though we still often associate museums with wealth and power, they are more often than not reflections of the collective shared wealth of communities they serve, and are still emblematic of a community's pride, but not necessarily a symbol of dominance. The art museum of the 20th century has changed radically and continues to change at a rapid pace. That change has been led by modernism's relessness pressure and its essential self-referential and self-critical capacity. As a result of these modern qualities, the modern art museum has successfully transformed itself from being considered a mausoleum filled with irrelevant objects or simply dismissed as a social club for the rich and ruling elite to that time where we are now considered an active center for the contest of ideas and values. In his 1909 Futurist Manifesto, the Italian theorist Filippo Marinetti called museums cemeteries and advocated their destruction as a critical move in moving culture ahead. 25 years later, the Museum of Modern Art was invented in New York in response to that challenge. Now, the museum here in San Francisco, which was evolved in the 1930s, not as a museum of modern art, but as the San Francisco Museum of Art, decided to call itself a museum of modern art in the 1970s. And that curious reaffirmation, at a time when modernism was already under attack, I think underscores the fact that, in some quarters, the modern museum and the idea of the marriage of the idealism of modernism and of modernity itself and the ideal goals fits quite nicely with our perceived and real understanding of the museum itself. Now, we assume that when we use the word modern to modify the art museum's type, as in a museum of modern art, we also need to consider that modern describes the museum's operating philosophy as well as its stylistic or thematic direction. In other words, do we apply the principles of modernism to the museum itself, or does it remain merely our subject? Of course, I'm being a bit rhetorical in posing this question, since we already know the answer. Surely we want to function as a modern museum of modern art. But as we approach that imaginary line that links the 20th to the 21st century, it seems convenient, if not actually necessary, to consider what modern means in this context. To take it at a very basic level, a modern museum is one in which there's a strong and direct relationship between what is shown in the museum and the methodology of showing, the ways in which the museum works itself. I'm not speaking about a simple correspondence between the container and the contained, but a deeper philosophical resonance between the goals of the museum as an institution, the things it chooses to collect and display, and the ways in which it organizes and presents exhibitions to people. This is not as simple as it sounds, for there's often an inherent conflict between the kinds of things one chooses to show and the museum's physical and invisible structures. There are unquestioned assumptions about the museum and its goals. If a museum, a modern museum, collects, at what point does it cease to be of its time and become a museum of a modern era rather than a museum still deeply committed to the modernist notion of innovation and timeliness? And the sometimes disturbing implications of radical change brought about by real innovation sometimes can sideline a museum from taking the kinds of risks that allow it to remain truly modern. Let me give you an example. The Bill Viola exhibition, which, as I said earlier, is upstairs in the galleries, represents the work of an artist making use of now commonly understood technologies, video, sound recording, large-scale video projectors, and yet he is still working in an area that's dramatically new to most people. The reason these technologies are already recognized as the appropriate province for creative expression is that art museums have insisted that our understanding of this medium be extended to include poetry. In the early 1970s, art museums led the charge for a generation to insist that the language of television be expanded to include the language of art and poetry. This was possible because of new technologies, but the new technologies alone would not have done it had it not been for the insistence on modern museums, museums which were willing to take the risk to ensure that their audiences understood that art was changing again, that technologies, as in the 19th century, had changed everything again, were continuing to change things at an even more rapid pace, and that artists were managing to keep up with that change. Now, museums have collected video work, and some even keep it on permanent view. And it was that programmatic insistence on the new that has allowed our public to keep pace with the rapidly evolving nature of art. Yet Viola and his generation have been around for nearly 30 years now. Those of you who are having your first experience of video art in this exhibition can recognize the fact that you are seeing the culmination of a career in relationship to a new medium which has developed in our own time. That's a very rare thing. We don't really often get to see something as radical and revolutionary as the development of a wholly new art medium. And yet, for the last 30 years, that is one of the things that modern museums have helped bring about. Yet Viola and his generation, those who've been around for 30 years experimenting and working in this new medium, cannot allow any of us to feel too comfortable. And it's important for the art museum itself not to get too comfortable, even with ideas that may appear to some of our visitors still as cutting edge. To be of our times today, an art museum needs to balance to continually bring new audiences and first-time visitors up to speed with the need to continue to support artists who are pushing out ahead into still uncharted territory. And so in the Bill Viola exhibition, we see 25 years of the work of one of the pioneering artists in this new medium. And yet at the end of the show itself, we see in his notebooks posed the very questions that are pushing him beyond one set of technologies, beyond one set of tools, and into another area. Now Bill Viola has been named as the first artist in residence at Intel, and he's beginning to work with even newer technologies and in a different frame. Now, the idea of artists working in cyberspace, working with computers, working in the digital age, is an example of the continuing role that the modern museum must play in order for the idea of modernity to continue to manifest itself within the framework of what we do. At this moment, beyond Bill Viola's beginning work, there are hundreds of much younger artists around the world working in this new medium that may very well make the art museum obsolete. That's right. At some point, these new technologies may make it unnecessary for the art museum to exist to support the kind of art that modern museums have supported for the last 50, 60 years. Why is this? Well, following the challenge of the artist-run space, the alternative space, which continues to provide a very healthy alternative to the traditional idea of the modern museum, artists working with this new technology in the internet, net artists is a way of describing them, have taken up a system of image making and distribution that could well eliminate the museum as a middleman. How fine it would be for artists to finally, to paraphrase the words of the Korean-born video pioneer Nam June Paik, each be their own channels. Not only would artists have direct home computer to audience access and be able to bypass the museum, the television station, the newspaper, or any other intervening medium, they would create a world in which the relationship and the identities of themselves as artists and their readers would continually be in flux. Nothing would remain fixed. And as we move into this strange new world of digital art, we'd best get used to the idea that the relationships that we've come to understand in the fixed museum world of solid architecture art museums will change. Now, I don't mean to say that the art museum as we know it now, the house for great works of art made in traditional media, painting, sculpture, photography, drawings, will disappear. Of course, that's never going to happen. This museum will exist, as will all great museums, in perpetuity to present a framework for the consideration, study, and enjoyment of these objects. And yet, this new development, as radical as photography was to the mind and consciousness of those in the mid-19th century, these new technologies will change our understanding and our grandchildren's understanding, more importantly, of the ways in which human beings interact with one another. Within the frame of how human beings interact with one another, we will find the subset of how artists make art and get that art to be seen, understood, and enjoyed by people in the world. Frankly, the modern ideal of the museum as a neutral, clean, well-lit space, stripped of the markers of the old style, freed from historical references, was in fact a myth. Of course, we know that the idea of the Bauhaus clean white space was as loaded with cultural signifiers as was any other form of architecture. But we all agreed for a time to believe that this was neutral space, that the clean white gallery space somehow didn't provoke, provide, or put anything in between the viewer and the work of art. It passed for neutral, or at least was seen not to be in conflict with modern styles of art making because of the consonance. The cognitive dissonance of that kind of relationship was limited, but it was false. The artist and critic Brian O'Doherty made it quite clear that this myth of the clean white space was indeed a false one, and that it was loaded with stylistic signifiers, symbols of class and power, and in fact created just as much noise in the minds of the viewer looking at these works as rooms that had flocked wallpaper, molding, and fancy accoutrements of the home. He noted that we chose to ignore the implications of the modern art museum because we wanted so much to believe in modernism's claim on neutrality, and because the power of the modern ideal, based on notions of democracy, tolerance, and openness to innovation, insisted that we believe in this mythology. Well, we're grown up now. We've experienced a century of modernism, and we can still embrace the ideals of modernism, the democratic ideals of openness and tolerance, without having to tie them to a particular style. In its all-embracing approach, the neutral white space of the modern museum, like ours, contains everything, and thus remains in control of everything. O'Doherty asserts that there is no bigger idea than modernity, and it's the claim of all of its backup and enforce that claim. The reality is that modernism's need to be seen as a totalizing frame has now been proven to be unnecessary, that the power of great modern works of art, of modern music, can sustain themselves outside of the condition of white space of feigned neutrality. But more important, the modern museum was and remains based on the model of factory production. the art museum is an entertainment and cultural experience factory. And Warhol's brilliant mimicry of the museum's deep structure only made it more apparent that his probing art wasn't limited to one medium or another. He understood the whole framework into which he was working. The modern museum uses as its base the ideal notion of the Gesamtkunstwerk, the total work of art, the greatest ideal of modernity. This ideal links us back to Clark and others who theorize about the link of the modern to the ideological proposition of modernity. Simply stated, the modern museum as not only a site for contestation, for the contest of ideas and values, but also a place for the literal and metaphorical re-knitting of a world torn apart by the alienating forces of the Industrial Revolution, including the growth of the modern city. In this sense, the modern museum links fine art, painting, sculpture, photography, drawing, etc., with industrial and graphic design, architecture, film, and the media arts, all of which are linked by their adherence to modernity, and also by an expression of the modern in one way or another. And we now accept this kind of integration as an idea, as an ideal for the idea of a modern museum. But what about alternative concepts of modern cultural production? Where do they fit? Where does outsider or naive art fit into this scheme? What about folk artists, self-taught artists? What about vernacular materials, snapshots, personal websites, quotidian objects of no particular design significance, and other things not intended as art by their makers, but that are seen as art by curators, collectors, or critics? What kind of structure is large enough to embrace the entirety of human production, whether or not it's declared art, and allow us to learn, to communicate, to engage in the essential humanity of the production of, of objects, images, and texts? It was understood by a generation of museum goers and museum professionals who were educated in the modern age that the physical appearance of the museum and the integration of its modern program was a part of its modernity, that it needed to be modern on all levels. But to me, that meant a couple of other things. It means to me, and to the future of this museum, that a museum has to see itself not only as a physical space, and by this I do not mean to limit the extent to which the museum's physical architecture is critical to our life, but rather that the art museum has to see itself as a social instrument, a part of a series of intersecting communities, each of which is not merely the museum's audience, but is in fact the museum itself. We need to learn to make to understand the difference between the institution and our audience and compare the two, understanding that one is in fact the other. If we can learn one lesson quickly from the explosion of the internet, it is that we must redefine how we understand the new relationship at first made possible by the net, but soon which will become an inescapable, and I think rather beneficial fact of the new modern life. Authority and the power it wields will rapidly change from a set of imposed structures to a set of implied relationships that can and will shift and reform themselves constantly. All art uses one technology or another, and so my enjoyment of video art, my engagement and hours in fantasizing about the digital art of the future means something on one level, but in effect, paint, steel, bronze, wood, all of these materials involve the use of one technology or another. So let's not get hung up on technology per se. We mustn't become so blinded by the new that we neglect the extraordinary ways in which more traditional media are still being used. And at the same time, we must not only embrace the new technologies, but we must bear a responsibility to help direct the ways in which they serve the needs of art, artists, and our communities. This means that museums must recognize that, with all due respect to the continuing efforts to broaden the demographic base for art museums and other cultural organizations, we have not yet succeeded in breaking down the class barriers that continue to make it difficult for many people to engage with, learn from, and enjoy the art museum's extraordinary resources. Over the 30 years that the National Endowment for the Arts has been in business, even during the difficult years of the culture wars, we are made very happy to learn statistically that because of the money that the federal government invested in arts across this country, 300% more people of color attend art museums and symphonies, cultural organizations across the country, than they did before the National Endowment was formed. And yet the same statistical surveys showed to us that the number of people who identify themselves as working class and working poor actually went down during that same period. The gap between the haves and have-nots and those who perceive the institutions of our cultural establishment as belonging to them continues to widen. And so we must expand and intensify our relationships to schools and other sites of continuing education, and to lobby actively for the resources necessary to bring art into the lives of our children if we're going to change those statistics in the future. The Art Museum of the 21st century must be, above all other things, an educational resource and an advocate for the broadening of our audience, for the education of the museum goers of the future. It means that we can't rest on our laurels and feel comfortable or smug or, or in any way satisfied by the large numbers of people that visit our museums, our symphonies, our libraries today. We must recognize that, if anything, those numbers represent a challenge in terms of who's not coming. It means that for the museum of the 21st century, a modern museum in a new modern age, that we must recognize that the notion of modernity can at best and must at its best be continually reinvented, refreshed by its own refusal to tether itself to a particular historical moment or ideology. The idea of the modern is more than just another ism. It is an attitude that is host itself to invention and change. At the same time, we recognize that the Art Museum, as I stated at the beginning of my remarks, is a place in which you may be encouraged to slow down. It is also an institution that can help people come to grips with change and renew themselves in a particularly open-ended fashion. While I still feel strongly that the Modern Art Museum of the 21st century will remain a site for the contest of ideas and values, it retains that role specifically because it can do so honestly and openly. Museums should and must be willing to participate in the dialogue that makes our cities and nations better able to support a free and open society. And increasingly, we will be called upon to stand as part of a community that insists on freedom of expression, unfettered free speech, and the presence in our society of that with which we may disagree violently, even art that we find offensive. Finally, the Modern Art Museum of the 21st century must remain a place of pleasure. But we must not get too comfortable. What I mean is that the museum must remain a place to delight in the works of art that have helped us understand what it means to be human in the 20th century, what will mean to be human in the century ahead, to participate in the genius that has in the past century transformed not only the arts, but all facets of life, to find and revel in the union that works of art construct between and among people. And yet we must remain aware of the ways in which we inadvertently rob art of its power to astonish and transform people. We must remain open to ways of remaining focused on, as Gregory Bateson would say, the food and not the menu. One of the pleasures I had in working as curator of Bill Viola's exhibition was to find myself immersed in his world of ideas. And one quite influential set of ideas that Bill led me to are those of the 11th century Persian mystic named Rumi. And I end my remarks tonight with his words. It's a good thing to think about when you're in the museum. You have seen the kettle of thoughts boiling over. Now, consider the fire. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David Ross, Director of the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, for your remarks here today. Now, Moira McMahon, who is the chair of the arts section of the Commonwealth Club, will conduct our question and answer session.
Thank you, Stephanie Salter. Mr. Ross, we have a large number of questions, so let's get started. Okay. Today's New York Times featured an article on the Boston Fine Arts Museum and its sudden reorganization. It indicated that curators are being sacrificed for the bottom line. What is your opinion of the role of expert curators today?
Well, the changes that Malcolm Rogers, the director of the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, made and announced recently and shocked many people were changes that are probably not understood by many, even in his own community today. He recognized, and I think we all do as museum directors, the critical role that curators play in the lives of our museums. They are the ones who help us best understand our collections and help our publics have great access to and take great pleasure from them. But what Salter, what Rogers is trying to do in Boston is to find a new way of organizing an encyclopedic museum. The Boston Museum of Fine Arts, one of the world's great encyclopedic museums, is taking a risk by looking at a new way of taking the millions of objects in that collection and finding a different way of presenting them, organizing the structure of them, rather than having them in departments that were defined historically over the decades, over the century that that museum has been in existence. Now, I don't want to comment on his decision because I'm not in his shoes, nor do I have access to the reasons that he has made these bold decisions. I feel badly for old friends and colleagues who've lost their job in this situation, and I'm very sensitive to how difficult it must be to be in that particular situation on both sides of the table. And yet I do understand and respect Malcolm Rogers' willingness to take a risk to try to reinvent what it means to be a great museum today. I think to make great change, you have to be willing to sometimes fail and to take stands that others may not understand, and I support him in that.
Okay, next question. How competitive has it become in securing art for major museums? For example, are there museums like the Getty that dominate the marketplace?
Well, I'm glad people are thinking it's the Getty that's dominating the marketplace. It's enormously competitive today, especially today because around the world is great wealth being produced, and that wealth tends to find its way, in the best of circumstances, into the ability of public art museums to acquire great treasures for their communities. We are constantly in competition, both in the auction house as well as in our attempt to acquire through private sale great masterpieces. There's a very fixed supply of great masterpieces and an ever-increasing number of museums around the world who recognize the critical role they play in helping to tell the story of art. We'll continue to be as clever as we can, and fortunately for San Francisco, this is a great golden moment in our city's economic life, and as a city we're able to do pretty well these days, but everything is cyclical, so we're enjoying our time at the top of the heap, and knowing that someday we'll be back at the bottom or maybe in the middle. But right now, I think we have very little to complain about.
Okay, as a follow-up for that, in purchasing works of art, what are your goals for SF MoMA?
The acquisition policies of this museum, which I feel quite proud of, were actually put in play by my predecessor, Jack Lane, and curators who were here before and those who are still here now. And that is to try to build a museum of modern art that has distinct qualities. That is to say, is not like a cookie-cutter version of every other museum. And so we've made a decision to try to find great areas of strength where we can build depth in our collection that makes this museum of particular importance in the understanding of the art of the 20th century, in trying to come to grips with what I was describing before as the complex puzzle known as modernity. We've decided, for instance, to make a great investment in the work of Robert Rauschenberg, one of the artists of the post-war American scene, who we believe has made one of the most important contributions of any artist of his time. That was a very conscious decision. Similarly, we've made a decision to collect in depth the work of Ellsworth Kelly. And so these kinds of pockets of depth in our collection are very important as we move forward, because there's a theory that strength comes to strength. And as you develop strengths in a particular artist, collectors who have works to give or collectors who have works that they want to sell will come to us first, and we'll be able to continue to build on that. Our goal is to try to reflect the complexity of the modern era while we also provide areas where research and can be done productively here. Now, while we're collecting in the historical period of this 20th century, we are also quite aware that the most active and economic way to collect, and in some ways the most fun, is to be very courageous and collect new art. And this museum spends a great deal of its time, energy, and money looking at new art being produced all over the world, looking at work being produced in studios by artists just coming out of graduate school, by artists who never even went to school, and placing our bet on the growth of those artists and the importance of those works. Great museums will always do that, will always share the risk with artists and support them before they're famous. In our design collection, we've done some extraordinary things. We now have one of the world's greatest collections of modern chairs. And the modern chair, if you come to think of it, is a wonderful way of looking from an architecture and design perspective at the evolution of modernism. And through the generosity of some of several local collectors and the generosity of the museum's Design and Architecture Acquisitions Committee, that collection has grown rapidly into one of the one or two best in the world.
Relates to the Calder exhibit. The Calder exhibit was fabulous. Do you have other blockbuster exhibits coming soon? And how long does it take from, quote, idea to, quote, exhibition to occur?
Well, three questions there. Do we have other, what was that word, blockbuster? Never heard that word before. We do have exhibitions on the schedule that we feel will be popular, that we feel will be popularly accessible, and with artists whose names you might recognize. In fact, next summer we will do a wonderful exhibition of the artist René Magritte. This fall, in October, we'll do an exhibition with our friends at the Dallas Museum called From Degas to Picasso. Both of those exhibitions will focus on extraordinarily important 20th century masters. The Magritte exhibition comes in the wake of us acquiring the marvelous painting Personal Values. Some people feel Magritte's greatest painting, which with the help of Phyllis Wattis we were able to acquire earlier this year, and that will be the centerpiece of this first opportunity since 1965 on the West Coast for people to see an overview of the work of the great Belgian surrealist René Magritte. How long does it take for an idea to exhibition to occur? Well, it can be anywhere from a year to 5 years. The Carlton Watkins exhibition on view now, Doug Nichols worked on that exhibition for 4 years. The Bill Viola exhibition, which is now in the second year of its tour, having started at the Los Angeles County Museum and then come to the Whitney when I was still there, began as an idea about 4.5 years ago. Large exhibitions and complex ones take a long time to marshal resources and to bring other institutions and their schedules into line. Exhibitions that are made from our collections can be done more quickly. Sometimes you just get lucky.
How important is art and education for SF MoMA's members and the general public? And please describe the museum's efforts and programs.
As I said in my remarks earlier, education is our most critical area in terms of our growth and in terms of our importance in this community. We bear primary responsibility for the education of the next generation, not only of patrons, and that would seem a little short-sighted of me, but the audience itself. If we care about the size and the composition of our audience, it's going to be our educational efforts that will allow that to happen. Now, this museum's educational efforts have been remarkable, both in our traditional museum's school visits, as well as in our non-traditional use of new media like CD-ROM and the Internet. And they've been so successful that over the last year, there's over 300% more desire by schools to use this museum as a primary place for education than we could accommodate. And so this museum is now in the process of expanding our education facilities. And within the next year and a half or two, we will open up a new suite of classrooms and another theater and other educational spaces so that we can accommodate the students, the children, the adult visitors who want and will enjoy learning from and engaging in modern art.
With the high cost of modern art, how do you establish its long-term value out 20 to 30 years?
Well, not all modern art is expensive. Those works that we are paying a great deal of money for have values that are established because of their rarity. And do we know for sure that a picture that we've spent X number of dollars on today will be worth X number of dollars compounded with the interest that it might earn during that period 100 years from now? Of course not. We actually don't buy art as an investment. We buy particular pictures because we feel they're critical in to our ability to tell the complete and rich story of modern art. And so, although it's very hard to find the money, we work very hard to assemble it. We're enormously grateful to those people who will part with their hard-earned money to help this museum buy works. Once we buy them, we don't think of their value in dollars anymore. We think of their value in the lives of the people who see them and whose lives and whose consciousness may be transformed by that experience.
What level of support for the museum is generated by memberships and admissions, and can museums today survive without large donations?
Let me answer the second part of that question first. No. We have a very active admissions and membership here at the museum. The San Francisco Museum of Modern Art has nearly 40,000 members. The only Museum of Modern Art with a membership in that level is the Museum of Modern Art in New York, our sister museum, which I think has 50,000 members. And so that's not bad for a slightly smaller city. Our admissions are very strong here. We, as you know, are in a city that is a beloved tourist destination. And this beautiful Mario Botta building, located in the heart of the Yerba Buena Center in this great, vibrant new part of the city, attracts millions of visitors a year to this region, to this part of town. Last year, nearly 800,000 people visited SFMOMA. Many of them who were not members and paid admission fees helped us sustain the cost of operating this institution, and they will continue to do that into the future. But the reality is that no museum, no matter how popular, not even if you're the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, which in fact is the most popular museum, or maybe the National Gallery in Washington, but I think it's the Met, no museum can live without endowment, without foundation subsidy, and without the support of friends and strangers.
Museums today have vaults filled with more pieces than they can show and perhaps care for. Shouldn't museums be encouraged to deaccession pieces to meet rising costs?
No. Museums do have rising costs, and museums do have a great deal of work that doesn't get shown for one reason or another. But we have to recognize that those treasures that are not on view, that may not be in favor today, may be in favor in 50 years or 25 years or 75 years in the future. It's not our role, and in fact, we step outside our level of responsibility and even our ability to know if we make those kinds of decisions hastily. I've seen time and time again, even in my own 30 years as a museum professional, when museums have deaccessioned works, and only 10 years from then found that they've deaccessioned works that have all of a sudden reignited in either critical or popular interest. But it's not only because you may have great work in the basement that you keep it. The collection that we have is, in fact, a text. It is a record of the collecting habits of this community and the patronage habits of this community. And so it's our responsibility to keep that text that is the collection as intact as possible, because it's a wonderful and very rich way of understanding the people who've lived in this city throughout this century, how they lived, what they thought was important, and what they thought was important enough to give to the museum, as well as what our predecessors who worked in this museum felt was important enough to either buy or to beg or borrow. And so those collections shouldn't just be seen as piles of assets, and very few museums would ever consider, in fact, no accredited museum would ever consider selling works of art to pay operating expenses. Sometimes, and I think this is legitimate, if you have a work by artist X and you have a chance to upgrade that work, to trade it for a better work by that same artist, that's often a very legitimate thing to do. If you don't need two works by that artist, or if they're of the exact same period and you can find a better example, then it's absolutely in the museum's interest to do what's in the public's interest. And it's in the public's interest to find the best work possible so that we all can learn and enjoy from it, again, as much as possible.
What at this time is the most significant vision you could achieve during your tenure at the museum?
Wow. World peace, I guess. I don't know. That's quite a question. I think that my tenure at the museum, and who knows how long it'll be, I hope it'll be a good long one, is something that I don't think about. But I do think that this museum is on track towards greatness. It's something that the men and women who have built this museum, have endowed it, have given their works of art from their personal collections to it, the artists who've supported it and given works to it over the years, have been working towards a moment that I see as quite possible now. This city has always been hospitable to art, has always been a place in which a museum of art and a museum of modern art has felt welcome and a productive part of the city. But now we're at a very different state, and it's possible, with the continued effort of everybody involved in our community, for this museum to emerge as one of the great museums of modern art in the world. The 20th century was one thing. We saw the patterns of business and immigration that focused attention and power on the East Coast of this country. The 21st century may be a very different thing, a very decentered time where commerce, where immigration, where the lives of people who are collecting arts are being lived very differently than they were in the early and mid parts of the 20th century. And I believe that San Francisco is particularly well located to be in the right place at the right time. And this museum and the others of our city as well should be the beneficiaries of that. I'd love to see that happen. But what I'd really like to see happen during my tenure, probably the biggest reach beyond the stabilization of this museum's continued growth, beyond the continued acquisition of great masterpieces for our mutual pleasure, I would love to see a time where the schools of our country, starting even just with the schools of our region, truly understood the value of art education in the lives of our children. I would love to see this institution play a role in a very critically important revolution in transforming our schools into places where creativity is honored and encouraged, and where art is recognized as a central way of learning, problem solving, and living in the 21st century.
Unfortunately, we've come to that time in our program where we have just about enough time for one more question. Pardon me, I have it right here.
I'm glad you're not here asking me the one about which is my favorite color.
Put that aside. Do you see a resurgence of representational art and a slackening of, quote, abstract art as we enter a new century?
That's a fascinating question. No, I don't see a resurgence of the figurative and a disappearance of the abstract. But I do see a merging of these ideas and an understanding that, in fact, all art is an abstraction of one kind or another. That representational painting, the painting of things that we can recognize, is equally a form of abstract sign making as is abstract expressionist work that we know so well from the work of Pollock or de Kooning or Klein. I see an ending of the kind of difference between those kinds of art making and a recognition of the role that art makes, that art plays in general. Now, I do see something significant developing in this moment that has nothing to do with necessarily representation or abstraction or that great divide. And that is, I do see artists extremely interested in identity. I see a lot of artists trying to understand how it is you represent human, individual, personal identity. And of course, that leads to a lot of portraiture, and portraiture is a form of realism. But the kinds of portraiture that are being developed range so broadly that Anthony Van Dyck would have a hard time recognizing what he may have set forth into the world of art as the great court portraitist of his time. But the concerns of artists to portray and communicate the sense of individual human identity remains a very central question to artists as we're seeing the centuries change. And for me, that means that there's a certain unease in the air, a certain sense of concern about what happens to our identities as we find ourselves immersed in so many new technologies. And at the same time, I think there's a great pleasure in recognizing and sharing something very human as we make and share our works of art. Thank you.
Our thanks to David Ross, Director of the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, for joining us today. We also thank our audience here in San Francisco and our radio listeners around the country. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the nation's oldest continuous public affairs forum, is adjourned.